Winchester Talking Newspaper, Friday, the 18th of June, 2021. Hello, and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. I'm your presenter, Roy Faithful. Your other readers today are Noel Thorpe-Tracy.
Hello.
And Nick Cairns.
Hello.
The extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 18th of June have been edited by Sonia Phillips, Sheila Shepherd and Sheila Shepard. Firstly, we apologise for the absence of a recording on the 11th of June last week. This was because it did not record because of an equipment failure, which had to be replaced the next day. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings of the Winchester Talking newspaper and the Winchester Talking magazine, or if you have a problem with the recording you have received from us, please telephone the contact number, which is on the key fob attached to the memory stick. If there's a problem with your sovereign player, please try plugging it in and recharging it before returning it as faulty. Now, the main headlines this week are Silver Anniversary of Village Hall marked by a mayoral visit, Health Services set for cuts, and Public Anger on A33 Pony Racing. So, may we have the headline story from yours, please, Noel?
Yes, Silver Anniversary of Village Hall marked by a mayoral visit. A party has been held to celebrate the 25th anniversary of a Village Hall. The Mayor of Winchester, Vivian Akhwal, and her consort, Dr. Sudhakar Akhwal, joined the trustees of the Lionel Tubbs Hall in Kingsworthy for the celebration. The hall was officially opened on June 1st, 1996, by the Mayor, Brandy Blunt. The Mayor accepted the annual rent of a bunch of watercress. Jackie Porter, Chairman of Trustees, opened the afternoon and explained that although the Tubbs Hall trustees had never received an invoice to pay by watercress, the trustees had decided that the hall's 25th anniversary would be a good opportunity to do so. Judy Curry, originally appointed as the parish council representative on the committee, and Elaine Fullaway, representing the Kingsworthy Youth Club, were the two original trustees still on the committee. Councillor Akhwal, Winchester's 822nd mayor, accepted the watercress rent and later said she had used it to make a watercress and paneer curry. Important guests included Frank Cannon and his wife Carol. Frank has given 17 years' service to the hall, firstly as bookings clerk with his wife Carol, who was the caretaker, and then as treasurer of the charity. For COVID-19 reasons, only 6 persons were allowed inside the hall. Whilst the mayor went inside to look at the hall, trustees Yvonne Spalding and Dorry Lawler hosted the mayor's consort, Dr. Sudhakar, and guests waiting outside. During the lockdown, the trustees have been working hard to ensure that the hall is COVID-19 safe and ready for reopening. Since expansion of the building in 2004, it's used by both the parish council and the Tubbs Hall, and facilities are shared with an excellent working partnership. The afternoon concluded with a few words from the parish council chairman, Les Haswell, who thanked everyone for coming and enjoying the tea, cake and sunshine. Tubbs Hall can be found in Harwood Place. And there's lots of pictures of the people, all the mayor, well dressed up there, dressers standing, receiving the bunch of watercress. And then there is a picture of the watercress being used in a mayoral curry, which doesn't make it look any more appetizing, but anyway, that's it.
Okay, Nick, let's have the story behind the second headline.
Health services set for cuts. Dozens of jobs could be at risk with health clinics across Hampshire closed for good and cuts to several services, it has been revealed. Health centres such as the Winchester Substance Misuse Treatment Hub and sexual health clinics in Alton, Hythe, New Milton, Ringwood and Romsey are at risk of closure. The number of venues providing face-to-face stop smoking services could go from 33 to 18, while the number of health visitors, school nurses and community staff nurses could be slashed, with 47 jobs at risk, around 12% of the 370 staff in that division. Other services at risk are HIV and syphilis self-sampling, as well as counselling for people experiencing psychosexual problems. Access to free emergency hormonal contraception, often called the morning after pill, at community pharmacies could be limited to those under 24. The moves are those currently being considered by Hampshire County Council in a bid to save £6.8 million by 2022. In total, the council is seeking to save £80 million by 2024, with possible closure of recycling centres and care services cut. The total number of jobs that would be at risk is yet to be confirmed. The council said the proposals come as opportunities to further reduce costs are getting harder to find. The public consultation closes on August the 9th, with a final decision due later this year. The concerns have been raised with the plans being described as a major blow and a slap in the face. A worker, like to be affected, who does not want to be named, said, "These cuts make a mockery of the public who clapped for their NHS. They should be outraged by this covert decimation of services, which have offered vital support for decades. These cuts will ultimately cost all of us so much more in human and economic terms. We are still dealing with a global public health pandemic, and HCC's response is to slash public health services, leaving children and families without the support they desperately need." The NHS Maternal Mental Health 5-year plan, soaring rates of domestic abuse, the overwhelming evidence that early years interventions really do improve health outcomes, should all be sufficient evidence to value the role of public health. According to official documents, hundreds of residents use these services each year. Callum Williamson, branch secretary at Hampshire Unison, said the proposed cuts would have a devastating impact. He added, "The most vulnerable would be the hardest hit. For our members who have given their all throughout the pandemic, this will be a slap in the face. The council must prioritise services for the most vulnerable and call out the government's callous indifference to what is unfolding up and down the country." According to the plans, children between 5 and 11 years would continue to receive the school nursing service, but those over 12 would only be able to access the digital advice. The move would help save £2 million. The councillor David Harrison, shadow cabinet for health at the county council, described it as a drop in the ocean. He also said the permanent loss of the Winchester Substance Misuse Treatment Hub will be a major blow, and added, "The proposals for cutting investment in all these essential services raise the prospect of dire consequences. You don't need to be an expert on public health to understand that preventing ill health is a great deal better than the costs involved if you fail to do so. Once again, we are seeing short-term thinking." Councillor Liz Fairhurst, cabinet member for health at the County Council, said the council's public health service is funded through a ring-fenced government grant. She added, "The service has worked hard to reduce its costs by improving efficiency and early intervention and prevention, thereby limiting the impact of savings on frontline service delivery. However, opportunities to further reduce costs are getting harder to find, and extra pressures mean that an additional £6.8 million must now be found. In order to meet the County Council's savings obligations, the service is proposing to refocus its budget to support the public health work being undertaken more widely across the local authority, as well as continuing to improve the health of the population and deliver key mandated services." According to the plans, face-to-face stop smoking services might stop at 15 places, including St Paul's surgery in Winchester. The consultation over the potential £80 million saving will run until July the 18th. Councillor Keith Manns, County Council leader, said opportunities for reducing costs are getting harder to find, as the council has reduced its spending by more than £500 million in the past decade. He added, "Our strong track record of careful financial planning has meant that the County Council is in a better position than most and has greatly assisted our ability to manage during the COVID-19. Nevertheless, the absence of a multi-year funding settlement from the government means that we continue to face a budget shortfall of at least £80 million over the next 2 years. Councils across England are facing the same budgetary pressures. This requires us to make more tough decisions about what the County Council can and cannot provide in the future. Do you have a view? Write to letters@hampshirechronicle.co.uk.
And the third headline story, public anger on A33 pony racing. Police boss Donna Jones was left in no doubt about the strength of feeling about the planned pony and trap racing in Micheldever later this month. Up to 500 travellers blocked the A33 dual carriageway last month for 2 days of illegal racing, disrupting travel for thousands of motorists. A repeat has been planned for Saturday, June the 19th. That's tomorrow. Police officers, hugely outnumbered, closed off the A33 and allowed the event to go ahead, sparking widespread anger. On Thursday last week, the recently elected Police and Crime Commissioner, that's the PCC, Donna Jones, attended a police beat surgery at East Tratton near Micheldever to hear local views. The PCC tweeted after the surgery, "Fantastic turnout at tonight's beat surgery in East Stratton, where the trap racing along the A33 was a key topic." The PCC talked to lots of people from the local community and reassured them that a comprehensive plan is in place for future events. Also at the event was MP Steve Brine and local city councillors Caroline Horrell and Patrick Cunningham. Mr. Brine, writing in Itchen Valley News Parish Magazine, said the event planned for June 19th had been escalated to a public order safety event. He added, "I will be leading the calls from constituents, coordinating your elected representatives at all levels to meet these plans with a show of strength that makes it very clear the A33 is not a racetrack and we do not want this here." As reported in the Chronicle, Ms. Jones called the blocking of the A33 wholly unacceptable and will not tolerate a repeat. Travellers in ponies and traps are common sights on country roads, but the May 1st to 2nd event was the first time they have held such a large event on the A33. A police spokeswoman said, "There is a policing operation in place. However, no further details will be released at this time for operational purposes." Speaking after the surgery, Mr. Brian said, "Donna has brought a new energy to the role of PCC, and she is rightly keen to engage with residents as much as possible. I don't think we can underestimate the importance of this level of visible neighbourhood policing to my constituents in this very rural area at a time of such heightened concerns around illegal racing." Ms. Jones said, "It was great to be out in the community and villages around Winchester yesterday with Steve Brine and the local police. The public have told me they want a commissioner who will not only listen but act. That's why being out in the community is the first month job is key." City Councillor Patrick Cunningham added, "I was delighted to welcome our new PCC Donna Jones and MP Steve Brine to this East Stratton Micheldever beat surgery to hear our many residents' serious concerns surrounding the illegal trap racing on the A33 and other major policing matters relating to residents' safety in the area. It was good to establish these lines of communication and to be able to bring these issues to the attention of people at the highest level to influence the course of action in combating these ongoing local problems and support the rule of law. And that concludes the headline stories. And now we continue with death notices, the Christian comment, followed by letters to the editor, first person, Bulgarum diary, editorial comment, and letter from Westminster. And we'll end with items of general news. We'll start with death notices.
Chalice, Sue Chalice, passed away peacefully at home on the 8th of June 2021, aged 79 years. Hartnett, Michael Hartnett, sadly passed away on the 6th of June 2021, aged 59. Hilton, Pamela Alice Hilton, on Monday, May 31st, 2021, aged 89 years. Porteous, Roger Porteous, Commander of the Royal Navy, died on 5th of June 2021, aged 78 years. Smart, Robert Bob Edwin George Smart, passed away at home on the 5th of June 2021. And Terminiello, Raffaele Terminiello, 7th of June 2021.
Over to Nick for Christian comment.
Which this week is entitled Wash Their Socks by Night. I don't know whether you have visited Winchester's new fish and chip shop below the Guildhall in recent days. If so, you have visited, perhaps unawares, some of the holiest ground in the city, and in one of its holiest seasons. The story of St Mary's Abbey, known as the Nunneminster, begins around the year 899 AD, with King Alfred and his widow. She founded it on the site of the current Guildhall and Abbey Gardens. For the next 640 years, the abbey was home to a community of Benedictine nuns. They prayed for the city, educated children, and cared for those in need. Among the sisters who served in the abbey, one in particular is remembered, Saint Edburga. As Alfred's granddaughter and daughter of new king, King Edward the Elder, Edburga could have chosen a life of ease and luxury. But instead, she chose a life of humility and service. It is said that as a small child, she was offered two piles, one of gold and jewels, and another with a simple communion cup and gospel book. Her choice gave a sign of the life she would choose. Despite her royal birth, she entered the abbey as a novice sister. She would remain there until her death on June the 15th in 960 AD. So, a visit this week would have played its part in commemorating a time when she is especially remembered. What struck people about Edburga was the extent of her humility. It was this which inspired later generations. She accepted the authority of the other sisters. She lived the rigorous monastic life without asking for special treatment. She prayed silently in the old church of St Peter, Colebrook Street. She took on the most menial tasks without complaint. The prophet Micah taught that this humility is central to what God requires of us: to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. It sounds so simple. But we know, all of us, how difficult it is to walk humbly. Part of us dreads humility and what we believe it will involve. We want to be loved. We want affirmation. We want glory and glamour. The paradox is that those things are in fact possible only through humility. It is when we recognise that we are not God, but instead are in need of God, that we can know God's love for us. Then we can enter into the covenant he offers, make unbreakable by the shedding of his own blood. We can shine with a reflection of God's own glory. Ed Berger is said to have cleaned the shoes and washed the socks of the other Abbey sisters during the night as they slept. As choir boys, we used to love, of course, changing the words of hymns and carols. While shepherds washed their socks by night, all seated on the ground, the angel of the Lord came down and glory shone around. Well, it seems our joke was a bit closer to the truth than we realised. When Princess Edburga washed the socks of her sisters, perhaps the glory of the Lord did indeed shine all around. And that was from Reverend Philip Crinks, the rector of St Faith's Parish at St Cross in Winchester.
Let's continue with letters to the editor. If you wish to contact the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by telephoning 01962 860 836. You can email news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk or a written letter to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, S0238AL. There are 11 letters this week, and I shall start with one now. This is from Geoffrey Moody, and it's entitled Times Change. Sir, Ray Jock MacDonald's letter regarding Stonehenge and the extensive traffic in a Chronicle June 10th, plans which will affect it, remind me of the annual pilgrimages there with my father in the early 1950s. It was rare to see more than 4 or 5 people on our visits. Sometimes we were alone. How times have changed, wrote Geoffrey Moody, Lakelands, Harrietsham, Kent.
And Sue Coles writes about the M3/A34 junction. Sir, we refer to previous reports in the Hampshire Chronicle, and in particular cycling elements of the scheme. Firstly, Highways England, HE, and its representatives are being disingenuous when they say a cycle link from Winnall to Kingsworthy is a new idea and that evidence is needed of the demand. Back in 2019, cycling advocates discussed this link extensively with the then project team, and HE agreed in principle to a shared cycleway footway as far as the Cart and Horses, subject to a bid for minimal funding for a short section of the route from Itchen Bridge to the Cart and Horses that was outside the scope of the scheme. In the new scheme, the project brief has been extended as far as the Cart and Horses at Kingsworthy, but the cycleway has been downgraded to a footpath. This is extremely disappointing and at variance with HE's own policies on minimising community severance, sustainability and cycling. This link would allow residents of Kingsworthy to cycle to the retail industrial premises at Winnall on a relatively flat route without going via the city centre. It would also allow cyclists to continue on the existing tarmac path as far as Highcliffe and so access the new sports and leisure park. In general, the entire scheme shows scant regard for non-motorised users and the need to encourage active travel. For example, the proposed cycle link through Junction 9, reconnecting the truncated Eastern Lane, does not fully comply with the latest national guidance and may not therefore be fit for purpose. Finally, the proposed bridleway within the South Downs National Park has been downgraded to a footpath, excluding both equestrians and cyclists. In our response, we shall be urging HE to keep to their earlier commitment and provide a scheme that reduces community severance and encourages active travel. We urge Chronicle readers to respond to the consultation and endorse these demands at highwaysengland.co.uk. That's Highways England is all one word, lowercase. highwaysengland.co.uk. And that's from Sue Coles, Cycle Winchester and Winchester CTC, Ruffield Close, Hairstock, Winchester.
And Chris Gillam writes on greenwash. Tsunamis of environmental hypocrisy are sweeping over us. Through my door comes an annual report from Steve Brine. Never mind the long section on how Conservative councillors are protecting our landscape from the very developers that Tory government has been progressively warping planning policy to serve. What stands out is, the environment was the issue that drove me into politics, and it remains my passion. This is shared by this government, and especially our Prime Minister. Quite. So, now we know why Steve Brine favours wrecking more of Winchester's landscape for completely useless, uneconomic and polluting road schemes. Now we know why he supports airport expansion at Southampton. It is because he shares the passion of Boris Johnson, who is probably the most anti-environmental Prime Minister we have ever had. And that is saying a lot. Does Steve Brine seriously expect us to believe that Johnson's setting world-leading targets for carbon reduction to be achieved by some future administration is any kind of plan? Johnson promotes a new and much more dangerous kind of climate change denial. He acknowledges the threat, but denies that anything needs to be done about it. A Mr. Micawber belief in something technological turning up to solve all our problems apparently excuses us needing to change behaviours. Indeed, this belief that the future will solve itself allows him to make matters worse, stepping up the monstrous road programme, £100 billion plus, and the nation apparently can't afford £4 billion to keep our promises on foreign aid, and airport expansion. Not that the greenwash is entirely blue. Some of it is orange. Lib Dem policy has been to support even the very worst road building crimes, specifically lobbying for the destruction of large swathes of the Stonehenge World Heritage Site. See Jock MacDonald's letter in the Chronicle from June the 10th. A Lib Dem council has approved the Southampton airport expansion. And a Lib Dem council in Winchester builds a traffic-generating car park to demonstrate its commitment to carbon reduction. The Greta message is, tell the truth. Real green policies are possible. But beware the orange and especially the blue travesties. And that's from Chris Gillam, Upper High Street, Winchester.
And this is from David Melton, entitled Wrong Junction. Sir, to illustrate letters criticising the proposed M3 Junction 9 scheme, you used a misleading picture of M3 Junction 12, which of course has free-flowing traffic and no problem. You should have used pictures showing queues on the approaches to Junction 9 on Eastern Lane, Spitfire Link and A34. The queue southbound on A34 can tail back to Three Maids Hill, so that traffic diverts down Andover Road through Winchester. Free-flowing traffic at Junction 9 between M3 and A34 would be a great improvement in many ways, reducing delays, accidents and pollution. That was from David Melton, Vernon Road, Week, Winchester.
And the Reverend Paul Anthony Newman writes about the word incredible. Sir, your correspondent's plaint about the misuse of English, Language School Chronicle letters, June the 3rd, resonates with a recurring exasperation I have experienced throughout the months of pandemic. Curiously, I was first alerted to it from the lips of Matt Hancock four times, repeated in a single paragraph during a COVID briefing. Subsequently, incredible has become the dominant adjective du jour, eclipsing the variety of alternative synonyms. I hope I'm among the host of readers who applaud John Miller's spirited advocacy of the BBC as one of the glories of our culture, Chronicle Letters, June the 3rd, though with one caveat. The proliferation of incredible from the lips of BBC Radio 4 broadcasters, commentators and interviewees has attained epidemic proportions as invariably superfluous hyperbole. Emma Barnett and Chris Mason qualify as inveterate trendsetters through their mimetic influence on the audiences. Others follow suit. And Nadia was reached when I heard an educated interviewee utter, "incredibly unique." Is there not an inherent irony in such linguistic debasement arising in the wake of an era of Trumpian alleged fake facts propagating a corrosively cynical scepticism or truth decay? An irony, moreover, compounded by recent critiques of Matt Hancock's accuracies. Paul Anthony Newman, the Reverend Paul Anthony Newman, Cranworth Road, Full Flood, Winchester.
Derek Whitfield writes on The Forgotten Wall. I read with interest Les Broad's letter in the Chronicle on May the 27th about the role of the Hampshire Regiment at the siege of Cut El Amara during the Great War. The Winchester local history group, The Great War Dead of Full Flood and Week, has recently completed a six-year project researching the lives of the men from the parish who died in the conflict. Of the 91 men listed on the parish memorials, no fewer than 17 died while serving in Mesopotamia, modern Iraq, as territorial soldiers with the 4th Battalion, the Hampshire Regiment. As civilians, they had worked as teachers, clerks, printers, carpenters, dental assistants, hairdressers, and most played an active part in the community life of Full Flood and Week. Some died in the Cut siege, but most fell victim to disease and ill treatment during the horrific march into captivity or while prisoners of the Ottoman Turks. Others were killed during the various attempts to break the siege in early 1916. Our book, We Will Remember Them, The Great War Dead of Full Flood and Week, Winchester, includes a chapter on the siege of Cut and the wider Mesopotamia campaign, which, as Mr. Broad correctly points out, has not received the attention of other theatres of war, such as the Western Front and Gallipoli. The book is, in part, an attempt to redress the balance and to remember those Winchester men who gave their lives on a very different foreign field. The book is by no means exclusively a work of military history. Our research has focused equally on the men's families and the role they played in the local community. There are also chapters on the development of Full Flood and Week in the years leading up to 1914, which we believe added significantly to our understanding of the area's history. It is planned to officially launch the book at St Paul's Church, Full Flood, in July. Further details should appear in the Chronicle in due course. And that letter's from Derek Whitfield, Avenue Road, Full Flood, on behalf of Geraldine Buchanan, Josephine Coleman, Cheryl Davis, Steve Jarvis, and Jenny Watson.
This next letter is from Stuart Attrill, and it's another one about the First World War. It's a general question. Sir, regarding a Brigadier General Robert John Tudway, I'm trying to locate the burial place of the general who died in a nursing home in Winchester in September 1944. If anybody has any information, please contact me on 01489 878 500. That's from Stuart Attrill, Midlington Road, Droxford.
Right, and Terry Gould says it's time to start. Sir, I wonder if anyone else has noticed the similarities between Silver Hill and Riverside Park. Neither have comprehensive development plans, and certainly one of them, Silver Hill, seems to have been stuck in the indecision lane. The consultation for Riverside Park is a beginning, but it rather desperately needs a comprehensive plan linking it to its surrounds, and then needs to come up with a workable development that is actually begun and carried out. As for Silver Hill, which has largely sat for 20 years, please, councillors and officers, start with what you can manage. Look seriously at Kim Gottlieb's plan for King's Walk, do the necessary archaeology, demolish the old Friar's Gate surgery, restore Lower Brook, and create a simple, easy path along it to connect up to the Broadway. Follow the SDP, use what you can of the JTL plan for the area, and developers will come and take on building the various parts once they see you are in earnest. And I don't mean Henderson's as a single developer, just in case various councillors are still enamoured of them. Just a simple beginning will be enough. Terry Gould, Fairfield Road, Full Flood, Winchester.
And Mark Long writes on bad driving. Sir, we have all been through very testing times over the past year or so with the pandemic. Now we are experiencing an almost normal way of life with the variants rearing their heads. Fortunately, I worked as normal during the testing times and would like to point out that many drivers have come back with aggressive behaviour on the roads and a lack of normal day practice, like signalling when needed. It has been a horrible experience for all of us, but when you get behind the wheel, try to remember a few of the fundamental points we were all taught to pass a test. And that's from Mark Long, Benny Hill Close, Eastleigh.
And this is from Steve Marper, and it's entitled Park Location. Sir, the North Wall's rec plan, put forward by the City Council's consultants, certainly includes some novel features, but arguably is a sort of scheme that would be more appropriate in a real city centre location, where the park was surrounded by built-up areas. Sharing more than half the perimeter with a nature reserve and playing fields, the site of the rec is surely more of a transition from city to countryside, so that apart from the sports pitches, the natural environment should predominate. This approach might still allow the grand archway or similar feature marking the entrance, and for some new all-weather paths to replace the present often muddy routes across the grass. But generally, surely no more grass should be paved over, and even perhaps some of the leisure centre footprint reclaimed for nature. If the proposed plaza and nature or observation tower were omitted, then perhaps the cricket pavilion, for which community support is already confirmed, could be fully funded more easily. However, the park is eventually redesigned. It needs to be better maintained in the future, so that the grass gets more attention in the winter, and, for example, glyphosate weed killer is no longer used inappropriately, and neglect of newly planted, including commemorative saplings, can be avoided. And that was from Steve Marper, Monk's Road, Hyde, Winchester.
And CJ Ashcroft writes about bad practice at Sports Centre. Sir, I can inform Mike Vokes, re your letters page last week, that he is far from alone in waiting in vain for telephone calls to be answered at the new leisure centre. The reason for the poor service is not extra interest in a new facility, nor teething problems, nor something to be blamed on COVID measures. It is simply that the new operator, Everyone Active, has chosen to perpetuate a bad practice that we endured at River Park for many years, i.e. expecting reception staff to also answer the phones. Those staff always seem to be busy enough with face-to-face customers, and they, quite rightly, deal with them first before taking incoming calls. Consequently, those calls can take several minutes to be answered, or often don't get answered at all. To be fair, Everyone Active is not unique with its attitude to phone calls, and many companies today seem to operate on the principle that if you stick to doing business via their website, then you are a valued customer, but try to contact them by phone and you become a bit of a pain and are treated accordingly. I could make a suggestion that when the 01962 848700 number is not answered within six rings, it automatically diverts to back office staff, so that some degree of customer service is maintained. But that obviously depends on levels of staffing elsewhere, knowledge of booking systems, etc. The other situation I was disappointed to see repeated was the understaffing of the new cafe. Just like over many years at River Park, I saw just one pressured member of staff having to cope with a queue of people, and as some of the drinks took time to prepare, so the queue grew longer and some people walked away. The centre has created a pleasant cafe setting, so why not staff it properly, give prompt service and therefore maximise the earnings potential? The new leisure centre has much to commend it, and these relatively minor changes would improve the service further to the benefit of customers and staff alike. That's from CJ Ashcroft, Main Road, Martyr Worthy.
And that concludes our letters to the editor. Thank you for all who contributed. This week's first person is by Joanna Lewis, and Noel's going to read it.
I am. It's headed Time for a New Career. I want a new job. Are you too, dear reader, longing for that post-pandemic career swap? A new challenge, maybe. I don't want to go back to the old routine. As the pandemic recedes and we move away from the new normal, I seek the completely different. I want unprecedented times, but on my own terms. The effect of being virtually grounded for a year has left many of us feeling restless. Try blue sky thinking, friends suggest. What, in an ideal world, would you like to do? Absolutely sweet Fanny Adams is my first response. But then again, the most contented people are apparently those who work a couple of days a week. Having a purpose still matters. So think again. What kind of job would make you happy? That's a no-brainer. I would work in that donkey sanctuary in Devon handing out carrots. Or as chief cuddler at Monkey World. But where would that leave all the serious important staff, like stopping environmental Armageddon and the concreting over of Hampshire? A full-time protester, maybe. An annoyancer, as opposed to an influencer. I have form, and it's in the genes. One of my great aunts in the 1960s, so the story goes, was devastated after watching a film about atomic war and the end of humankind. She lived in South Wales, so you might think tragedy and hopelessness were not new to her. Nevertheless, the impact on the retired teacher was so great that when a nuclear submarine docked in Swansea, she got on the bus and chained herself to something she shouldn't have. Then she got arrested. But protesting, alas, cannot be a way of life if you need an income. Plus, we feel like we've been in prison for the last year already. When I eventually find my passport, and it'll be nice to use it one more time. So, I'll get back to you on going to jail for now. What then do we most like doing in work in case we could just do more of that? In lockdown, I did more pastoral care and individual coaching for my students, mentoring with footnotes. Sharing tips on mental health awareness and resilience strategies were as helpful to me as they were to them. This is clearly a huge area post-pandemic where young people will need support. Here's a way forward then. We can retrain at any age, but there's one big obstacle for me in any career change. The job interview. The thought terrifies me. I am a disaster zone. In one interview, when I sat down after my presentation, the chair collapsed. In another, I sat out in the garden during lunch, waiting for the panel interview. It was a hot day in July. I fell asleep, got sunstroke, and turned up 45 minutes late. I couldn't see anyone properly. They thought I was on drugs. At an interview in Oxford University, I got the dress code wrong. Under my linen jacket, I was wearing one of my aerobics t-shirts. Halfway through, the jacket unbuttoned itself, opening to reveal a neon slogan emblazed across my front, Pop-Tart. Might have cut it for Mr. Motivator, but for Madam Oxford Professor, it did not. She then turned back on me for the duration. At my next interview, I asked for an overhead projector. They wheeled out this Byzantine structure, like something you might scale a fortification with. No one could see me or hear what I said above the whirring of the internal mechanism. Even interviews for positions I got make me quake. An internal candidate for the job I do now was in the audience with her allies. When my notes blew off the table because of a sudden draft, they just laughed, whispering and smirking throughout my presentation. Lesson for the day, don't give up the day job.
Nick's now going to read an alternative look at the news, because he's going to go over Belgarum Diary.
And three pieces this week from the diary. The first one, Ian Fraser's Road arrives. Take 10 Chesil Theatre New Writing Festival. The winning road taken. The theme for entries in the 2021 competition was The Road Not Taken. More than 400 writers from all over the country submitted 10-minute plays, most taking a metaphorical approach on how choices and events can alter a life. However, Ian Fraser, one of the 10 winners, went even so far as to name the road, the M56. This motorway plays a key factor in the drama he submitted, A Grand Day Out. Ian, who has lived in Winchester for 30 years, is a biology teacher. Studying science at university was one of the choices he made when deciding which path to follow in life. "I wanted to be an artist and novelist," said Ian. "My father pointed out that employment in those worlds was hard to come by. And, of course, he was right. I chose biology because it gave opportunities to draw, and I discovered a love of teaching the subject." In his free time, Ian paints, sketches, designs stage sets and writes. Ian took a creative writing course run by the Adult and Higher Education Division, AHED, of Peter Simmons College. He focused on travel writing initially, with the aim of submitting magazine articles. He also attended a Winchester Writers' Festival weekend at the University of Winchester with conference director, the late Barbara Large. "We had to write the synopsis of a novel and the opening chapter for assessment. I received such positive feedback, both at the weekend and meeting Barbara afterwards. It really encouraged me to keep writing." Ian's entry for the 2018 Chesil Theatre New Writing Competition was longlisted, and he is delighted to have been declared a winner this time. A Grand Day Out, with the 9 other winners, will receive a full production over the weekend of the 2nd and 3rd of October. "I found that the 10-minute rule imposed a discipline and structure to my writing," explained Ian. "To establish a backstory, characters, relationships, and intrigue the audience within that limit was a stimulating challenge." And that piece is accompanied by a smiling picture of Ian Fraser, the competition winner. So the second piece is MBE for Media Boss. Henry Four Walker, Chief Executive of NewsQuest Media Group and Chairman of the News Media Association, has been awarded an MBE in the Queen's Birthday Honours list. The honour has been given for services to regional news journalism and charity. Henry has been CEO of NewsQuest, the company that owns The Chronicle, since 2014. He has worked in local news publishing for almost 20 years, having previously been digital director for Johnston Press and general manager of the Scotsman Publications. He chairs the News Media Association, the industry body representing national and local news publishers. Henry said, "It's an absolute honour to receive this award, but the real recognition should go to the amazing people that work in local news publishing across the UK. It is their news brands that not only provide their communities with essential trusted news, but also provide such valuable support in championing charities and promoting local businesses. NewsQuest publishes over 150 local news brands across the UK." And, of course, there's an accompanying first smiling photo of Henry Four Walker MBE with that piece. So, the third and final bit from Bulgarum this week. Top prize for equine student. She is the best equine undergraduate in the country. University Centre Sparsholt student Sophia Farino has won first place at the 2021 Equine Science Symposium, which took place virtually this year. Her abstract, called An Investigation into Self-Perception of Body Image in Female Equestrians in the United Kingdom, is part of the research being conducted with the Centre's British Horse Foundation Lecturer Bursary Funding. It was presented alongside research projects from undergraduates studying across the globe. Written in collaboration with UCS lecturers Lorna Cameron, Natalie Stones and Dr. Marianne Freeman, the research explores self-perception of body image and the potential impact on well-being and performance in the equine industry. Judges at the symposium were delighted by Sophia's research and strong presentation skills and said, "This was one of the best presentations I saw during the conference."
Time for editorial comment. Think again over public health cuts. News that Hampshire County Council has launched a consultation on axing swathes of the public health service beggars belief. Where has it been for the last 18 months? If ever there was an example of a public authority out of touch, this is it. Hard to believe, but the County Council is actually considering cutting substance misuse treatment, anti-smoking measures, health visitors and school nurses. The council may save some money, but the overall cost of the public purse would far outweigh that. Have they considered the impact on crime, children's early years, mental health, eating disorders, neglect, to name but a few? If the county council wants to save money, it could have a harder look at its own bureaucracy. This is no specific criticism of the council, because all large organisations, the BBC and the NHS, spring to mind, develop the same self-sustaining momentum. The cynic may say these proposals are just a ruse, that the reaction will be so intense that it will make the actual lesser cuts, bad enough though they may be, look much more palatable. Noel's got letter from Westminster.
Yes, letter from Westminster by Steve Brine. On Monday, we learnt June the 21st would not be Freedom Day after all, and MPs were asked to approve the continuation of restrictions plus an extension of the hobbled hybrid parliament. I did not vote for either. Anyone who thinks it's just another few weeks and we'll see this off is not following the logic of what delay means. We've vaccinated over 3/4 of the adult population. 30 million people, including me, have received their second dose, and we've double-jabbed the most vulnerable. So the question remains, delay for what? As the chief scientific advisor says, COVID is now an endemic disease. I'm not cavalier about this. I'm a former health minister who looks at the whole picture of what we're doing to our country while facing the reality and the rhetoric of accepting we must learn to live with COVID. The reality is, it doesn't matter if we're being held in semi-lockdown by the Delta or Nepalese variant, new strains of COVID are inevitable. They will pop up in one country to be exported abroad, and they will continue to occur unless we eradicate COVID completely from the planet. And there are still those who think we should do exactly that, the zero COVID campaigners, who don't want just zero COVID deaths, as we saw in the data recently. They hold that one case of the virus is one too many. Last year, lockdown measures were a necessity, and I voted for them, not least because our hospitals were full with seriously unwell people. This week, we received very little national data on who is actually in hospital and why. I checked with our trust, and on Monday, we had 4 COVID patients across 3 hospitals, none in ICU, not exactly overwhelmed. Deaths and hospitalisations are actually well below Sage's best-case scenario when the exit roadmap was composed. So it's legitimate to ask, how much better than the best-case scenario do we have to do before we reach stage 4? We're told that public opinion supports delay, and many do, but the job of government is to lead public sentiment and to give the fullest picture, not one that backs up a particular scientific theory. There are many who simply do not have skin in the game. They go to restaurants, see family, and even freely go on holiday, but they still get paid at the end of the month. That is true of the academics who fill each day's airwaves, the media, and yes, politicians. But if you work in travel or hospitality or the events industry, it's very frightening, and being open doesn't mean making a profit. The evidence presented this week was not persuasive, and I remain concerned that both the 19th of July may not be the terminus claimed and the restrictions may come back in the autumn. I've been unable to get reassurance on either point. Chris Whitty says any new surges will meet a wall of vaccinated people, and he's right. We're not going about our lives liberally out of carelessness, but out of an acceptance of risk. Whether we fully reopen this month or next, or push it back again, we will face an exit wave at some point, and summer is a good time to do that.
Lighting up time ends on Friday the 18th of June at 4:49 a.m. and begins at 9:23 p.m. On Wednesday the 23rd of June, it ends at 4:50 a.m. and begins at 9:24 p.m. We'll continue with further items of general news, and we'll start with one read by Nick.
Yes, this one's entitled Charity Confirms Care Home Closure. Moorside Care Home in Winchester will close its Board of Trustees as confirmed. The Board of Trustees of the charity that runs St John's Winchester met on Monday and affirmed its closure, likely to be by the end of September. It said no workable way of keeping the care home open has been found during the consultation. The specialist care home for people with dementia has high operating costs, but as a charity, St John's is constrained as to charges, and its income, much of it from rental incomes on high street properties, has been declining. The trustees said the decision follows careful consideration by the board of the results of the charity's consultation exercise with families of Moorside residents, Moorside staff, almshouse residents and staff charity-wide. Chairman of the board, Roger Bright, said, "We want to thank all those who took part in the consultation process for their thoughts, ideas and suggestions, which we have considered very carefully. Regrettably, however, no workable solutions emerged as to how to close the funding gap between our reduced income and our costs in a way that would allow St John's to continue to operate Moorside and provide the high standard of care which we consider so important. Our high care standards are achieved first and foremost through the skill and endeavour of our staff. But the small scale and configuration of Moorside as a building also requires a generous staffing policy to maintain these care standards, and, sadly, this comes at a significant financial cost which we can no longer sustain." Chief Executive Clive Cook said, "Now that the decision to close Moorside has been taken, the charity's number one focus in the short term is to achieve the best possible managed closure of the home. We will offer full support to residents, their families and our brilliant Moorside staff, whose contributions were kindly acknowledged by families of Moorside residents, especially in meeting the enormous challenges posed by the pandemic. We will keep open good lines of communication with relatives throughout the process and work closely with the families and Hampshire County Council to achieve the best possible outcomes for our residents. Whilst we would expect that the home will close by the end of September, the precise timing will be determined by the needs of our residents and their families. We will not rush the process of helping our residents find suitable homes in a safe way. The closure process will result in staff redundancies, but the charity will support employees with an enhanced redundancy package, expert help to prepare CVs and to hone interview skills, and by doing what it can to help staff find new work. St John's plans to repurpose Moorside for up to 18 new almshouses, which will provide fully adapted accommodation for older people of limited financial means. The first steps in that process will begin over the next few months." Mr Bright added, "All of us here at St John's would like to thank the family members who took part in the consultation and applaud our Moorside matron and staff, many of whom have committed to staying with St John's until closure is complete. We are still reflecting on the consultations and will be taking on board a number of suggestions. And that piece is accompanied by a picture of Moorside Care Home in Winchester with an inset of Clive Cook, the chief executive of the St John's Winchester charity.
Traffic measures here to stay. It's one of the most controversial traffic calming measures the city centre has seen, but the closure of Hyde Street looks to be staying until at least September. Hampshire County Council is looking to remove most of its temporary emergency active travel schemes. However, those in Winchester are likely to stay. These include the Hyde Street closure, the pedestrianisation of the square and the Broadway, and the lane closures in North Walls, which has been widely criticised for causing congestion. The traffic regulation orders had been earmarked to end in September anyway, and the council looks to stick to that date. A further update will be reported to the July Executive Member for Economy, Transport and Environmental Decision Day. City and County Councillor Martin Todd said, "I'm really pleased that this City Council scheme in the square and the Broadway looks set to be guaranteed until the end of September. While there are still things to improve, it's generally working well. The City Council team is working with residents, businesses and county offices to improve the scheme still further and to ensure that it can continue after that date. In terms of the other county schemes in the city, there's an urgent need to listen to what residents said about them and the proposed improvements to them, adapt the designs where possible, and get improvements in place as far as possible, and as fast as possible too. In the rest of the county, the plan is to take everything out as soon as restrictions end, and then put some of them back in later. That all seems a bit weird, I know. Some other councils aren't doing this, and where schemes are supported locally, such as Eastleigh, pretty counterproductive. I'll be challenging this decision at the meeting next Thursday." This comes after the County Council announced it would be reviewing temporary emergency active travel schemes across the county. Since May 2020 and the award of £863,000 of government emergency funding, a total of 42 emergency schemes across Hampshire towns and villages were delivered. Councillor Russell Oppenheimer, the County Council's Executive Member for Highway Operations, said, "During the pandemic, the emergency schemes were necessary to support social distancing and give confidence to the public that it was safe to go back to the shops. I know there's been a mixed reaction to the emergency schemes, and I'll be reviewing the officer's report carefully before making decisions next week. The lesson learned will be certainly feed into the next feed. No, the lessons learned will certainly feed into the next phase of active travel measures." And there's a whole whack of photographs here. There's one looking down Hyde Street, where everything is closed. There's one of Martin Todd standing in the square, looking happy. And behind him, there are people eating and drinking outside Three Joes. And there's a photograph of the market in the Broadway, which doesn't seem to be very well attended at that time. And there's a lovely picture of the traffic calming and the pedestrian protection in North Walls, just outside the tattoo shop.
Overhead lines to go underground. SSEN is undergrounding some of the overhead power lines in Bishop's Waltham. I'm afraid there's no evidence what SSEN stands for, except it's obviously a power company. The £150,000 programme in South Downs National Park is underway, across land on Franklin, Dean and St Clair's farms. Over the course of the summer, the energy provider will excavate just over 1 kilometre of the farm's land to replace the existing poles and cables with modern, robust underground cabling. Work will also remove the necessity to carry out future tree-cutting works on the vegetation that lines the nearby bridleway. Carl James, SSEN's project manager, said, "I'm delighted to be working on this scheme, which will improve the views for so many local residents and visitors to this stunning area. The initial proposal for the works came from the town's stakeholders, who identified this area and applied to SSEN for the works to be approved. After carefully considering the environment, the landscape and how the works would be carried out, SSEN gave the green light to the project, which involves over 1 kilometre of the overhead network being undergrounded to provide an uninterrupted view of the local area. A small ground-mounted substation is being built to replace the overhead transformers, helping to provide a more resilient power supply. The site had been proposed by local stakeholders as having the potential for visual improvement through the removal of the overhead network, and through subsequent consultation and analysis of the works was approved. Mr. James added, SSEN is working closely with Franklin Dean and St. Clair's Farms throughout this project to prevent any disruption the excavation works for the underground cable may cause and to accommodate their important planting and harvesting schedules. While SSEN's overhead infrastructure provides a secure and cost-effective way of safely distributing electricity to homes and businesses, the distribution operator appreciates that the network can have an impact on the natural environment.
Group that delivers blood given honour. A group of volunteers which deliver blood and medication to the NHS have been honoured for their efforts. Serve Wessex, the Blood Runners, a group of volunteers operating in Hampshire and East Dorset, has been honoured with the Queen's Wall Award for Voluntary Service. The group provides an out-of-hours rapid response service to NHS hospitals, delivering blood, blood products, samples, medication, medical equipment and human donor milk during the times when other transport options to the NHS may be limited. As well as this, they also resupply the blood and plasma carried on the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Air Ambulance and critical care cars. The volunteers were nominated for the award by the pharmacy departments of Basingstoke and North Hampshire Hospital and Queen Alexandra Hospital, Portsmouth. The national honour recognising outstanding contributions. And that piece is attached by a lovely picture showing the Isle of Wight Air Ambulance helicopter and all the team stood in front of it in their fluorescent jackets and I think it's about 5 or 6 motorbikes there, which they obviously use, 4-wheel drive blood car and 2 vans as well.
This is about some more volunteers who provide vaccination transport. And they have been running elderly and disabled people to and from their COVID vaccination since January. But the volunteers behind JabCab are not about to stop their operations in Highbridge just yet. The scheme is run by Amanda Lana of Inert Recycling Co. UK Limited. She said, "We've raised money for cancer research and Alzheimer's research. Most of our passengers have donated a couple of pounds. We're continuing to run until all elderly, disabled and vulnerable people have been fully vaccinated. A big thanks goes to my sister and fiancé who have given time to run this free community service." And there's a great photo of a people mover with free safe travel to your vaccination with our jab cab and 3 volunteers standing outside of it.
Charity walk. Hampshire residents have been invited to lace up their trainers and get walking this summer in aid of people living with a chronic, life-limiting autoimmune condition. The charities Scleroderma and Raynard's UK, SRUK, is asking people to get involved with its nationwide walking challenge and raise money for research and support for people with scleroderma. Scleroderma occurs when the body's immune system becomes overactive and begins to attack healthier tissue, causing hardening of the skin and, in some cases, other organs. It is most common in adults over the age of 40 and can also affect teenagers and young adults, though this is much rarer. Walkers have the option to make their walk physical or virtual, and as long as as short as they need. The fundraiser, called the SRUK Walk, aims to raise at least £19,000 to represent the 19,000 people in the UK living with scleroderma. The money will be used to support people affected by the condition and fund research to improve diagnosis, treatment and quality of life. Sue Farrington, SRUK chief executive, said, "The past year has taken a toll on many people with scleroderma who have been forced to shield and in some cases have their treatments put on hold. We want to make sure we can be there for everyone who needs us, which is why we're asking people to put their best foot forward, a simple act that will help to make a world of difference."
Police make arrests over converters. Police have arrested three men after a spate of catalytic converter thefts across the Winchester district. The men were arrested in Fareham, but have been linked to six offences, including one in Shawford, where someone was shot with an air rifle. Officers were called to an address on Fernham Road, Fareham, at 3 a.m. on Tuesday. Three men were attempting to steal a catalytic converter from a vehicle, and damage was caused to three vehicles on the victim's driveway. The offenders fled, but were quickly detained on Duncan Road, Park Gate. A man from Southampton, 28, a man from Totten, 34, and a man from Hythe, 24, were arrested on suspicion of theft from a motor vehicle. The incident has been linked to other thefts across the county, including an attempted theft in Pearson Lane, Shawford, where the victim was also shot with an air rifle, causing minor injuries.
Council slam for mowing verge. The city council has been criticised for mowing a grass verge in Kingsworthy, destroying an area adorned with wildflowers. Winchester City Council carried out the work in North Road last month during No Mow May, which is a campaign encouraging people not to mow green spaces to allow wild flowers to bloom, providing a feast of nectar for pollinators. Resident Thomas Patrick Gilmartin was saddened to see that the authority had ignored the initiative. He said, "Of course, much will grow back in time, but why mow so low and so often? And why mow at all when it's so beautiful and at a peak time for wildflowers and the wildlife which feeds from them? It seems to be greatly saddening lots of people across the city. It has destroyed a beautiful and heart-lifting scene for no good reason. The grass was not tall and to the detriment of wildlife. Is it possible for you to ask the council about this? Fewer mows, higher cuts and where possible no mowing at all in many places." He posted about the incident on the Wild Winchester Facebook group, which sparked more criticism of the city council. One commenter said that it was pure vandalism, with another saying, "I was devastated to see that a patch all mowed this morning. It was so beautiful." A city council spokesperson said the council piloted No Mow May across three sites in the district, West Hill Cemetery, Olsford and Badger Farm. "This reduction in cutting will be rolled out to other areas of the district if this pilot is deemed to have had a positive impact. Under the present agreement with Hampshire County Council, we're obligated to undertake a certain number of cuts per year, and any changes have to be agreed by all parties, as Winchester City Council, Hampshire County Council, Highways Hampshire, and contractor ID Verd." And there are two photographs. One is of a lovely verge with wildflowers growing, and another one looks like it's been completely flattened.
Riverbank closed off to public after damage. Part of the riverbank of the Itchen at Itchen Stoke near Alsford has been closed off because of antisocial behaviour. One of Hampshire's special areas of conservation, SAC, has been subjected to trespassing, forcing the landlord and the local parish council to shut part of the river. Large groups of people, many from outside the local area, have been trespassing on private land to gather on a stretch of the river, also designated a site of special scientific interest. Signage making clear that there is no public right of access have been vandalised, and the disruption to wildlife and fragile biodiversity has been dramatic. Local residents have been forced to clear the river, its banks and the surrounding fields of broken glass, litter and even human excrement. David Cook, chairman of the Itchen Stoke and Ovington Parish Council, said, "At times we have groups of in excess of 100 people over a weekend, and the damage that they're doing is, in most cases, irreparable. The impact on the local wildlife, destruction of the riverbanks, and general antisocial behaviour has become intolerable. Mr. Cook and residents have been working with the landowner, Lord Ashburton, to close off the stretch of river, and last week the area was secured with a security fence. Lord Ashburton said, "We do not take the decision lightly, but the situation is increasingly untenable, particularly for those whose properties back onto it. The destruction of the area, impact on local wildlife and danger to livestock is severe. So, in agreement with the parish council and local residents, we are left with no other alternative than to close access and reinforce that this is private land." There is a footpath through the land that runs alongside the area, and Lord Ashburton underlines that people are permitted to use this for walking, as they have done for many years, to walk the Itchen Way from Water Lane to Abingdon Road. But he points out there is no right for people to depart from the right-of-way, swim in the river, picnic and loiter. This is the second issue over access to the river, following controversy last year at Chiland. And there is a mixed picture, because it's lovely scenery, but it shows the fence going up on the ridge at River Itchen at Itchen Stoke.
This piece takes us back to medical matters, with a surgeon's worry over City Hospital. A consultant surgeon has questioned health chiefs on proposals to move some emergency care out of Winchester, suggesting that City Hospital beds could be empty. Francis Goulder asked bosses at Hampshire Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, HHFT, which runs Winchester Hospital, what services will be available at the Romsey Road site once a new hospital is built. Plans are currently being developed for a new hospital in or near Basingstoke to serve the people of North and Mid Hampshire. Miss Goulder said, "I know that the plan is for outpatients to remain in Winchester, and that the plan is for people to be able to come in and have scans and endoscopies and day case minor things. It seems to me that what makes a hospital is having ill people in beds, and I would be very interested to know whether there will be any inpatient beds. How many inpatient beds will be in Winchester?" She questioned whether a child would be able to have their appendix out, or an elderly woman with a urinary tract infection could be admitted for a course of antibiotics. "These are not rare things that need to be sent to a tertiary referral hospital. They are very common, very frequent. At the moment, we have got 300 beds full of patients having stuff done. Is the plan for all of that to go to Basingstoke?" she added. Dr. Lara Alloway, Chief Medical Officer for the Trust, responded to Miss Goulder during an Ask the NHS meeting, organised by Winchester's MP Steve Brine. Dr. Alloway said that options are still being worked on, but the lessons have been learnt from COVID, which will impact new hospital plans. She continued, "What we have all learnt is the need to be able to separate our electable plan surgery. So our desire for Winchester is all the things you mentioned. Outpatients, scans. We absolutely want to be able to see people who have minor injuries, minor illnesses, and to have a planned surgical centre. So not day case, but actually all surgery, even if it requires an inpatient stay. But not if it is likely to require the support of intensive care, because that we see a benefit in centralising. All of your examples are emergency admissions. Now, if an operation clearly is an emergency and requires admission, then we are wanting to centralise that into our acute hospital, and there are many benefits." Miss Goulder claimed that around 95% of patients currently at Winchester Hospital were emergency admissions, but this was disputed by Dr. Alloway. She also fears that much of her work, elective and emergency operations, would be moved up to Basingstoke. And there's a small inset picture there of the old Winchester Hospital.
Stable blaze battled by three firefighting crews. Firefighters tackled a fire involving a wooden stable block at a farm at Upham, on Tuesday. Crews from Bishops Waltham, Eastleigh and Hightown were called to the scene at 2:21pm on June the 8th and found smoke and flames issuing from the structure upon arrival at the Winchester Road farm. The blaze began within loose hay before spreading to the stable as the owners helped evacuate the horses. Firefighters used four sets of breathing apparatus, one jet, two hose reel jets, ferrum water carrier and an on-site digger to extinguish the fire. Three adults were treated in the scene for minor smoke inhalation before fire crews left at 3:17pm. The fire service said there were no further updates. And there's a huge photograph of this. There's two firemen looking quite, you know, we've done the job now. There's a digger, which is obviously digging and covering the fire. And there's a picture of all the hoses snaking out towards the stables.
Uncovering the remnants of life in World War One Army Base. Archaeology doesn't have to be focused on the Romans or the Middle Ages. A team from Winchester University has been uncovering evidence of buildings that are little over 100 years old. Around 25 students and their teachers have been on the site of former Mourne Hill Army Camp, a massive base on farmland to the east of Winchester during World War One from 1914 to 18. The excavation in two trenches is focused on the prison stockade set up on northern edge of the site by the Americans, hundreds of thousands of whom passed through Winchester on their way to the Western Front in 1917 and 1918. The jail would have mainly dealt with minor misdemeanours of being drunk or disorderly or fighting. They should save their fighting up to later. Leading the dig has been Dr. Phil Marter. He said, "This dig is part of the project to see what survives of the camp archaeology. We know more or less what the camp looked like, as we have the plans made by the Royal Engineers in 1919. We're hoping to understand how the prison stockade was constructed and find cultural material." The diggers found items such as buttons and broken crockery and part of an early motor engine spark plug. The stockade itself was surrounded by posts and barbed wire, with the huts made of prefabricated steel and corrugated iron and a sturdier cell on concrete blocks. Dr. Marter said the dig served a wider purpose. It's not just about trying to understand where the archaeological remains are under the fields. We're trying to get people thinking of things from the First World War that can be archaeology as well. As live witnesses disappear, we have fewer and fewer ways to explore that part of the past. Archaeology is a way of exploring the First World War, not just to focus on the trenches. People have dug them up, but there has not been so much focus on the infrastructure back home in Britain, the huge effort to get all the men out to the Western Front. We want to highlight the importance of that. The Mourne Hill camp was vast, and there are some estimates that 2 million passed through on their way to France, leading from Winchester down to Southampton Docks and on to Le Havre in France. It was large enough to hold 50,000 soldiers at any one time. And there's a picture here, a World War One postcard of the prison stockade at the Mourne Hill camp east of Winchester. It's a black and white photograph, and it looks just like prison camps anywhere.
Good boy hit man in face with bottle. A good boy who left a man with a scar on his face after hitting him with a bottle in Winchester has avoided being sent straight to prison. Kyle Bell, 18, and his brother Jordan were involved in a confrontation with victim Azar Sumro, who had been socialising with their sister. But the altercation turned violent when Bell, who was 16 at the time, had a momentary loss of temper control and struck Mr. Sumro across his face as he turned to walk away. Bell was convicted of unlawful wounding following a trial and appeared at Winchester Crown Court to be sentenced. Jordan was found not guilty of affray. Mr. Sumro will have to have reconstructive surgery for the visible scar, but the incident has made him anxious about being attacked. The recorder, N. Casey, added, "He is repeatedly asked what caused it, and he repeatedly has to relive what caused the scar." The court was told that Bell of Sheridan Close Stanmore brought the bottle to the clash, but said that he did not intend to use it. In mitigation, Paul Fairley said Bell is the good boy, according to his grandmother, as his brother is a prolific offender. Mr. Fairley added, "We are effectively dealing with someone who was a child at the time and now, according to the pre-sentence report, lacks maturity." During the hearing, Recorder Casey said, "The defendant brought a bottle to the incident, not necessarily intending to use it. He and his brother decided to have a confrontation that only needed to be verbal." The recorder added, "The defendant's brother probably bears some responsibility for this defendant being in the dock." Bell was handed a 20-month prison sentence, suspended for 2 years. He must also do 160 hours unpaid work, 20 rehabilitation days, and must pay £800 in compensation.
Green Group speaks on new car park. A charity is urging the City Council not to waste money on car parking amidst a legal battle over a new multi-storey. Winchester Action on Climate Change, WIN-ACC, opposes the construction of the new park and ride in Bar End. The City Council approved the plans back in April and groundworks have already started. But WIN-ACC believes money should be used elsewhere, and if the legal battle fails, it would like to see the number of city centre spaces reduced. A spokesperson said, "The City Council shouldn't waste money on car parking. The City Council is the important but challenging target of reaching net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. Transport, mostly cars, is the biggest single cause of emissions in Winchester District. Fewer people travel to work now they've had the experience of working from home during lockdown. The council shouldn't encourage people to drive. If they do create more car park spaces at Bar End, they should definitely reduce car parking spaces in the centre of town by at least as many places to reduce air pollution." Residents of Doman Road have applied to the High Court for judicial review over the decision to approve the car park.
Plans to convert former coach house criticised. Plans to diversify a country pub and open rooms in a rundown outbuilding have been met with criticism. A former coach house building at the Dove Inn, Mitchell Deva Station, is proposed to be converted into 5 letting rooms, each with an ensuite bathroom. The proposal has been submitted by pub owner and former Winchester City Councillor Kim Gottlieb under his company Lock Still Limited. It would see the demolition and recreation of the coach house, which sits behind the pub, to create accommodation along with a terrace. The proposal also states that there would be a reconfiguration of parking and external seating areas. But the application has drawn criticism from neighbouring residents who have aired their objections to the City Council. They have raised particular concern about the existing sewage treatment plant, STP, for Brunel Close and the pub, which they say already cannot cope. Aaron Brown of Brunel Close said the plans submitted only make a passing mention of a proposal to install pub's own sewage treatment system. "There are no details. We on Brunel Close are fully aware of the issues we have had with our own failing sewage treatment plant, and personally, I'm worried that the planning application does not have this nailed down." Others also fear that if the plan is approved, there'd be an increase in noise from those using the accommodation. Julia Wood, also Brunel Close, objected to the application and said, "Current noise from the car park is already amplified due to this, and voices can resonate into our bedroom windows. The plan to site these letting rooms even closer to our back gardens will mean more noise. And whereas locals know to use soft voices when in the car park late at night, guests will not. The current rooms let out in the main building are ideal, as guests use the front door and can go straight to bed from the bar." Mr. Gottlieb and the application has stated that the additional letting rooms would improve the viability of the inn once things return to normal. He said to the Chronicle, "The pub industry has been in some difficulty for some time, even before COVID. It has been experiencing a tough old time, and so we have had the idea of creating some more letting rooms to expand that facility at a later date, also creating more options. The building has been derelict for some time, and it makes sense to make beneficial use out of it. The building has not been doing anything, and we have tried to find a good use for it. Mr. Gottlieb has also assured residents that as part of the plan, a new STP will be installed solely for the pub.
I'm afraid that concludes the extracts for the week ending 18th of June 2021. Thank you to our editors, Sonia Phillips, Sheila Shepherd and Sheila Shepard. Thanks to our copying and dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks to today's other readers, Noel Thorpe Tracy.
Goodbye.
And Nick Cairns.
Goodbye.
And from me, Roy Faithful, thank you for listening. Goodbye for now. And I hope you stay safe and well in the week ahead. When you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and please place the correct address label on the front of the wallet too and return the wallet as soon as possible. Thank you and goodbye again.